There's a fascinating project that's going on at Muhlenberg College these days, and it is looking at correspondence between students during the World War II era and the college, and writing back and forth to each other. It's spearheaded by Susan Falciani, who is one of my guests this evening, and she is assisted by Dr. Kate Ranieri. Let me just tell you, this is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY Allentown. We serve the Lehigh Valley. It's good to have you with us this evening. Susan Falciani is the Special Collections and Archives Librarian at Muhlenberg College's Trexler Library. She's responsible for implementing the Special Collections Instruction Program, curating exhibits, maintaining the college's archives, digitizing the unique collections, and expanding outreach to both the college and local Allentown communities by linking the college's history to the wider historical narrative. That is a mouthful. Susan, how do you have time to go home?
I make some time. It's a busy schedule, but it's extremely, extremely fulfilling. There's always a new project that my list is long.
Well, as I've had several conversations with you, I realize that you are extremely excited about what you do in the library. And just let me tell the listeners, this is not a gray-haired woman with her hair tied back in a bun. Is that a stereotype?
It is.
As you peer over your glasses at people?
It is, but it's something librarians are working hard to change. So it's falling by the wayside.
Well, we worked a little bit on changing that with Marion the Librarian and the Music Man. So Susan, prior to holding this position, worked in the rare book trade. And when you say rare book trade, what does that amount to?
I started, after my undergraduate degree in history, of course, working for an antiques auction house in New Jersey. And that was a very general auction environment, porcelain, furniture, books, etc. And I wanted to specialize. And so I got a job working for a rare book dealer, also in New Jersey. And I worked there learning the trade, learning what first editions are, learning how to catalog in a large warehouse with about 500,000 books in it. And I did that. And I also worked as an auctioneer for a year in New England as a rare book auctioneer. And then I decided to go to library school. I decided that the research aspect of it was a better fit for me. I tried to hold on to my knowledge of books and kind of parlay that into the next phase. And so it's extremely rewarding to work on it from the academic side now.
And you just love old books.
I really do.
When it comes down to it.
And letters, as this project will illuminate.
As we will mention a little bit later. Susan has a Bachelor of Arts in History from the College of William and Mary, and she also has an MLIS. What does that stand for?
Master's of Library and Information Science.
From Rutgers University. So before we get into talking about the project that the two of you are working on at Muhlenberg College, let me introduce Dr. Kate Ranieri, who is assistant professor, teaches in the Department of Media and Communication at Muhlenberg College. One of her favorite courses, documentary research, provides students the opportunity to abandon spectatorship and become active co-conspirators in their own educational process. What a statement. Is that your own? Did you pilfer that from somebody, Kate?
Who knows? I don't I just really like it because it is a move, an intentional move on the part of our department, and also certainly with the way I teach the class, that they are not passive in this. They have to really commit to knowing who they are as storytellers and also knowing what their obligations are to those stories we tell. And so it does require a lot more active education.
Abandon spectatorship and become active co-conspirators. It sounds a little shady.
It does. It sounds like I probably pilfered it, but for now I can't say.
If you put that in the court description, I bet you get students who are just intrigued by that statement. The most recent iteration of documentary research has been a collaboration between Dr. Kate Ranieri and my other guest, Susan Falciani, the college archivist. Is it archivist or archivist?
Archivist, but that's a good question.
Thank you, archivist, to introduce students to primary research methods with the goal of producing short documentaries about life on campus during the World War II era. What is the final... let me mention first that Dr. Kate Ranieri has a Bachelor of Arts from Cedar Crest College, and she has Master and Doctor of Education from Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, right?
DeKalb, Illinois, correct.
Mm-hmm. You came a long way from DeKalb.
I know. The commute was terrible. But
how did you wind up in the Lehigh Valley?
My husband was working for Air Products, and that's what brought us back here. Because I've lived here in Pennsylvania before, so that was the link.
Where are you from originally?
Texas.
What part of Texas?
Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Big D.
That's right.
All right.
Yes.
That's another musical show.
It's another story,
yeah.
too.
Another story, another
yes.
life.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And Susan, how about you? Where are you from originally?
New Jersey. Born and raised, and except for a short stint in college, I still live there.
You went down south to college, and you picked a great one, William and Mary.
I did.
Who's the most famous graduate from there is?
Jefferson, of course, Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson, yes. And then he went and founded that other university. And
that we don't talk about.
Yeah,
we trained him.
That's the big rival, right? Yes,
correct.
You trained him very well. So... Susan and Kate, let's get into exactly what this project is of yours. It has to do with correspondence during the World War II era, but you're also asking the students to do documentaries.
Correct.
So let's take those two angles.
Right. Perhaps we've got to start from the beginning just a little bit. Susan, you could start perhaps with the exhibit that you had.
Sure. I started at Muhlenberg in January of 2014. And within a few months of arriving there, I got a message from the Development and Research Office saying, we have some folders and some files of alumni, and we are scanning them, and we want to put them probably in dead storage somewhere. But some of them look like they have World War II letterheads on them, and they're from the 40s, and is this something you might be interested in? I'm a history major for life, yes.
You jumped right in
there.
I
was very, very intrigued. And it was a great project at that time to give me something, since I was new, to kind of take ownership of and feel, you know, to have a project and a direction. Because it can be, it's overwhelming to come into an institution and try to become the historian or a historian of that. And that institutional knowledge goes back so far, and it's a very broad scope. And so this was a doorway into that with a focus. So there are approximately 1,000 letters from about 200 different correspondents. These are letters that were written by Muhlenberg students, alumni, participants in the V-12 program, which we'll talk about more later on. That was the Navy program that was the base that was operational at Muhlenberg. And they were corresponding with the gentleman, his name is Gordon Pfister. He was the director of public relations at the college. And most of the letters are addressed to him and to John Wagner, who was the alumni secretary. But he stepped away for a couple of years because he went to do his own service. There are a few letters that are addressed to President Levering Tyson and a few faculty members. But the bulk of the correspondence is really to the alumni department.
And this is from GIs who were students at the time at Muhlenberg, or were they alumni already?
There were some who were alumni. There were some who were current students who had interrupted their educations in order to go serve. And some of them had actually graduated from Muhlenberg through this Navy program and then were serving. So they were had accomplished both at that time. And one of the things that is particularly interesting and possibly unique about our collection, I've made a few calls, I'm not 100% positive, but in addition to the letters that we received back from the servicemen, we also have carbon copies. They're bright pink and purple and faded, carbon copies of the letters that were issued out to them that our offices were writing. So we really have both sides of the conversation. And that is, I think, unique. One of the The letters, the folders of letters are of varying different quantities or sizes. Some of them are very thin and they only have one or two letters that just say, hi, here's a change of address. Please forward my mail to here. Glad to hear that the football team did well, you know, this season. But others are two folders thick, the correspondence. We have one gentleman, Wilmer Cressman, who we will talk about at more length, who wrote about 100, I would say, 50 from him and 50 back to him, that had a very close relationship with some of these staff members after the 4 years here at Muhlenberg, and really it was a very personal correspondence. So there's a mixture of that in terms of depth of the correspondence and personal.
Right. So the project starts with Susan saying, do you think one of your students would want to do a documentary about this?
These are students of media and communication.
Correct. And they're sophomores. And my thought was, this is a really large project to take on as a documentary project. And that students only have a semester. They work, you know, our clock is semester by semester. And this is a project that would take on a lot longer time. And so I said, well, I'll work on it with you. And then,
were the two of you friendly before this whole project came up? Did you know each other? And that's the reason, Susan, that you reached out to Kate particularly?
I was on the library committee, and I was on the special committee when we were looking to hire an archivist. So, yes, I've been.
We were friendly. We had an acquaintanceship.
Yes.
But
right.
Thanks to this project, it's become a much bigger collaboration and friendship.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we were real excited to have Susan come on board. So, yes, I've been here from the beginning. So the project was something that I thought was too big for one semester of students, and one thing led to another, and we really started thinking it through and thinking we could look at smaller stories, individual men, individual stories about what life was like on campus, not war stories, but what was going on? What were some of the practices on campus that we don't really hear much about? And that's where we got started with those stories. And so,
and in those days, no female students.
Oh, absolutely not.
So
no, the first female students at Muhlenberg came in 1957. Although there were, what is now the West Coast School was the evening college or the extension school. There were females being trained as teachers as far back, I believe, as 1920. Right. But as far as official members of the day school, that was not until 1957.
The extension school is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe you've already said, Susan, what prompted you to begin examining the World War II era at Muhlenberg. Who were some of the important Muhlenberg players in this story?
Well, in addition to some of the people that I've mentioned before, President Tyson he's one of our favorite characters in this story, but he is incredibly pivotal. He became president of Muhlenberg in 1937,
correct.
And he was the first lay president. He was the first time that we had had one who had not been a Lutheran minister or was still a Lutheran minister at the time that they assumed this responsibility. And he had been involved in radio in New York City. He had a cosmopolitan aspect to him, and I think possibly a broader worldview than what had been previously in the administration.
Right.
And that really played out in a lot of ways. Some of the programs that he brought to campus, he was largely responsible for introducing a sociology department. He employed our first female faculty member in the early 40s.
Began the psychology department,
yes.
Expanded that, so brought arts to the campus, you know, in terms of changing the curriculum from strictly a theological, you know, classical perspective to seeing the horizon as a lot, you know, longer trajectory. So you see, as Susan said, that sense of moving from a rather provincial perspective to something a lot more cosmopolitan. So he did bring a lot of new ideas.
Including, and he was responsible for, in 1947, we had our first contingent of African-American students at Muhlenberg, and that was after the war events, but we have correspondence and materials from him relating to that, to pursuing that and instituting more diversity on campus. So he was absolutely pivotal in
bringing President Tyson.
President Tyson, correct. As you can imagine, at the time war was breaking out, small colleges all over the country were facing a crisis because the boys wanted to join up. They even before Pearl Harbor, there were programs, there was a push. It was towards the tail end of the Depression, young colleges were facing an absence of tuition and basically students. And I believe our enrollment dropped, I think, from in 1937, 1938, being around 550 students approximately, to by 1940, they were facing, I think it was more like 150. I mean, it was a huge,
unsustainable situation for us. And, you know, so Tyson had his back against the wall. So it was very clear that something needed to be done. And that's when the Navy V-12 possibility came on the horizon, and he did a lot of work in D.C., Washington, D.C., arguing for Muhlenberg's behalf to bring the Navy V-12 program to campus, which he was successful in getting it here.
And we were one of 131 colleges and universities that participated in this program. And actually, in the records that we have telling the story of the program coming, nationwide, the program began on July 1st, 1943. But anecdotally, we were actually the first school that opened on that Monday right after the first, that actually had the infrastructure in place, had the food, had people signed up, had everybody in their bunks, in their barracks, and were ready to start classes on that first. We were the first one to have it together.
In their bunks and in their barracks on Muhlenberg campus?
Yes, right, sir.
Quonset huts?
There were Quonset huts, yes. In fact, where the library is located now, it was that big sloping and Center for Arts and that whole side of Chew Street, there were Quonset huts there. But what is now, well, East Hall became the East Barracks, and what is now Brown Hall, which was then known as West Hall, and that was the West Barracks. And they civilian students were moved into a fraternity house. Mm-hmm. Because there were still civilian students. I believe there were about between
small
like 75
group,
and
right,
100 possibly,
right, right.
And they were moved into the fraternity houses.
Wow, that is such a different student population from what we see today.
Well, absolutely. Very few people know that it was a Navy base. And when we say a base, it meant that it was Camp Muhlenberg. It was not Muhlenberg College per se. It was the military in that particular time for the needs of the war took over. I mean, their military presence was the ruling force.
Yes, yes.
But it was also a saving grace for Muhlenberg.
Wow, what an interesting history. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver, our operations director, is working the board for us this evening. And my guests are Susan Falciani, Special Collections and Archives Librarian at Muhlenberg College, and Dr. Kate Ranieri, who is Assistant Professor of Media and Communication at Muhlenberg. It's time to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to explore more of World War II correspondence and projects that students are doing nowadays on that. Stay tuned.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
We're back on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're talking about correspondence during the World War II era. It's students and also alumni from Muhlenberg College who were abroad. Were all of them abroad, or some of them just in other parts of the U.S.?
Many of them were in training camps that were in the U.S., yes. So there was a mixture. But we also have plenty of letters that across the top, of course, that say somewhere in France, somewhere in the Pacific. We have letters that have been censored, that right, were clipped and then taped back together with this yellowing cellophane, mm-hmm, cellotape.
Or it's just completely cut out because they would just take a pair of scissors and cut the words out.
There was one gentleman who was, he served as the censor. He was the official censor on his ship. So he would, he had to, obviously he knew what to say in his own letters. But when it, his envelope is stamped with his initials in it as the official censor who passed his letter through, because that was his function.
All right. And the idea was if they said somewhere in the Pacific that the person did not know where he was, or that he was not to divulge that?
Not to divulge that, because they wanted to be very careful that if there was any interception from the Germans or whom, Japanese, they just wanted to make sure that no one knew where what their exact whereabouts, the location.
So in the course of, in that first summer of 2014, when I received the letters and I read through them and I had my student worker and a volunteer, Actually, Gail Watering, not a volunteer, she's a local school librarian, and she works for us in the summer. She has for many, many years, long before I arrived, and she's been invaluable in this project. And she, so we read through the letters, and we were keeping note of anything that was particularly interesting that might be worthwhile to mention in an exhibit that I then planned. So we were looking for descriptions of battles and mentions of ships sinking and the discussion of Muhlenberg and how the outreach that they were doing, that the college was doing to reach out to the boys, was so much appreciated. That's a whole theme in the letters that can be drawn out, is the fact that we sent, the college sent them stationery that had a little General Pete, General Peter Muhlenberg, who for alums, they'll be familiar, who might be listening, he was on the stationery. So there was a big push to support these gentlemen who were serving. There was a biweekly newsletter that was sent out. They were called Victory Flashes from Muhlenberg. So that was a general mailer that went out in addition to these personal letters that they then corresponded with. So in the course of trying to plan an exhibit for around this material, and there's a lot of photographs because this was a huge initiative. Having the V-12 program there was a big thing for the school. And so there are numerous photographs, I would say dozens of photos of students marching across campus, students training, doing physical, doing PT.
Right. And they were training in the
pool.
The JCC with the Jewish Community School too, that they needed a pool. And so that was the pool for our V-12 program. And so they did a lot of maneuvers underwater. And so we have shots of them climbing through what looks like bird cages almost.
Where was the pool?
At the JCC, which is the Jewish Community Center, which is on
22nd and Tillman.
Right.
It's still there.
Yes, yeah, because it was one of the, Muhlenberg almost wasn't selected because it's a Navy program. And so there are underwater obstacle courses that are part of this physical training. Mm-hmm. And since Muhlenberg didn't have a pool, that was almost a problem, except the JCC was so close by that we were able to
march over there.
In. Exactly.
Which is what they did. They marched everywhere.
So in addition to the photographs, the letters, a correspondence about setting up the program, we have logbooks that list infractions of students. So if somebody was lagging behind when he was marching, he would get demerits. If he cursed in the barracks, he would get demerits. So we have a lot of material to support and tell this story. So
if he fell asleep while he was on guard duty in East Hall, what happened and that sort of thing. So we have, and we actually have interviews that connect to those infractions as well.
So in the course of planning this exhibit, I requested from the Development and Records Office to have a list of names and addresses of Muhlenberg alumni who had served in World War II. And I received a list of 110 gentlemen, and I sent out a questionnaire asking about the V-12 program, asking about your memories of Muhlenberg, and a few other things were on there. And I got responses from about 20 to 25 men who wrote back. Some of them were so eager to talk to me, they called and left messages. One of them was Major Nathan Klein from Allentown. So he, by the time I got back from vacation, I remember he had called me a couple of times saying, you need to come over and see my memorabilia, and I'd love to talk to you about my time there. Two of the gentlemen, a doctor,
Richard Meyer. And William Fritz.
Yes. They had come into the program. They were there July 1st, 1943. Dr. Fritz had come from Wisconsin.
Right.
And Dr. Meyer.
He's from Illinois.
Illinois, yeah. Yes.
From Western, close to St. Louis. And so, you know, they both landed in Allentown and they're like, where are we?
Exactly.
And that's, but the Navy had a very intentional program of bringing people from diverse geographical regions to have a nice mix, which that was a pretty progressive sort of thing to do at
exactly.
the time.
In those days.
And those two ended up together in the V-12 program. They both went to med school and practiced afterwards, and but we've interviewed both of them, but they were just befuddled. Like, it was a very, very hot and humid day. I recall that one very clearly.
Yes.
Do you know where they wound up practicing medicine?
Certainly. Bill Fritz was at Johns Hopkins and was on faculty there as well. And Richard Meyer was in Quincy, Illinois as an ophthalmologist. Fritz was internal medicine.
And in their initial response, they both replied to the questionnaire. They both asked about each other. And could you provide his address? We've lost touch over the years. And then when we visited each of them in Illinois and in Maryland, they asked about each other, and hopefully we put them back in touch if they...
Well, also, they weren't sure they wanted to be interviewed, but they egged each other on, and so it was to our benefit that they did that.
And so the two of you travel around?
Yes.
Yes.
Together?
Yes.
Mostly the two of you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you've been to Maryland?
Illinois. Florida. North Carolina. Yep.
All right. Yep. And these gentlemen now are in their 80s?
90s.
90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they have been, again, one of the things I think I've found most surprising is that they say, well, I don't know if what we have, if my story is that interesting. I don't know why you want to interview me, but if you want to come, by all means, come on down. And we've tried to convey to them that this is history, that it may just be a memory of your youth or your college years when you were 20, but this is so important. And so that allowed us, the responses that we got to the questionnaires gave us contact information to allow us to start recording oral histories so we could ask some of the questions that arose from reading through the documentation, reading the Muhlenberg Weekly, getting to know some of the prominent names. We then could ask, how well did you know President Tyson? How much of a personal connection did he have with the students? Dr. Fritz told us about the sergeant.
Schultz.
Yes. Yes.
So he was, Bill Fritz was on duty, guard duty at night, and he was really tired, and he was trying to study very hard. And he fell asleep, and Schultz came in with his baton and whacked him on the desk and said, Fritz, do you know what the penalty is for falling asleep on duty? And he's like, no, sir. And he was standing there just shivering, like, oh, my goodness, I'm going to be in such trouble. And he goes, the penalty is death. And, of course, it was a joke, but not. And so he remembers that and performed that, actually, that whole scene when we were interviewing him in Maryland last year.
Was that the inspiration for Hogan's Heroes?
I don't think so.
But one of the things that's so interesting about interviewing them in person is because we have an impression of, all right, there were Navy students, trainees who were in the V-12 program. There was a small contingent of Marines also. But what we got from the interview was the understanding of that there were different groups and even cliques, perhaps, of students, because there were, in addition to wanting to bring students from other parts of the country and to experience new locations and diversify a little bit, the Navy would send students to schools that supported a particular need. Muhlenberg was then, as now, very strong in pre-med, pre-dentistry, and theology. And so students who had an interest in becoming doctors, it behooved the Navy to send them to an institution that had those strengths so that they could then, and the idea of the program, it was an accelerated degree program. So there were 3 semesters a year, it went year round, and students could graduate more quickly. So they would have their bachelor's degrees, they could go into officer's training. And
to med school.
And to med school.
Dental school, or go to the Lutheran Ministerium, which was in Philadelphia. The idea was that we'd have more chaplains, we'd have medical officers on our ships, that sort of thing. That was what was really pushing that way. So we did send quite a few people to med school.
And that was the Navy's advantage. Right. And Muhlenberg and the other colleges then received the tuition that the Navy paid. So many small colleges were able to stay afloat because of that program.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It was It was interesting.
Do you have a figure in your head as how much the tuition was in those days?
Oh, boy. That's a good question.
I don't.
No, I think it was somewhere around 300 or something like that. It was way... it was more like a cost for a dinner of a family of four.
Yes,
it was
right. Very small. We'd get you one week maybe at a college today.
Right. So what these interviews provide for us also was a way for us to understand things that we just... no archives can provide. And so we had, in talking with different men, an understanding of what Levering Tyson was like as a president, what life was like in terms of the dean of freshmen, of how they were like in loco parentis, you know, treating freshmen like they were their children, their family. They were a substitute for the parents. How Levering Tyson groomed seniors to survey kind of, you know, surreptitiously what was really going on campus. And so you get a whole kind of different story about other aspects of people's lives, the adults on campus, than we could get necessarily through just looking at letters, just looking at the Muhlenberg Weekly, which was a school newspaper. So they fleshed out a lot of things for us that we have found fascinating. Those are the interviews, I mean.
And all of that footage is now part of the archives.
Right.
So it helps to tell this story. And that's part of, as we've pulled together all of the sometimes separated material that relates to this project, we've compiled it, we've added to it, and we're seeking to both preserve it for the next generation, for it to be rediscovered again in another 30 years, perhaps by the next archivist who gets really enthusiastic about it, but we're also seeking to make it, to share it with the public, with students, with prospective Muhlenberg students, with researchers. And that's why we're looking to, where we've created a digital presence for this material. And that does include the student documentaries. And so one of the things we realized as we were researching, we were interviewing these gentlemen, Kate teaches a course in documentary research, and it's, as she mentioned, a required course for the major. And so we thought, here's an opportunity to have students learn to do primary research, to work with primary sources, to learn to feel comfortable in an archive, and to also feel comfortable with the sheer discomfort and unknown of what materials are there and what aren't, what isn't there. And so often students may have gotten into the habit of feeling, oh, I'm going to write a paper about this. This is what my thesis is. And this parlays into documentaries as well. This is what I want my project to be about. And they'll come to meet with me in the archives and they'll say, can you give me everything that you have about John Smith? Mm-hmm. I want to tell his life story. Well, we don't necessarily have the documentation to tell that story. We have whatever someone thought to save 75 years ago or 100 years ago in terms of what's in the archive. And that can be very, make students feel very unsteady because they're used to being able to look things up in a database or find a book about it or...
find the correct answer. And documentary research is not just one, it's not an absolute, it's very... very much of gray area. I mean, there's a lot of ethical considerations, but they're looking for the right answer, and it's like there's not a, you know, the singularity.
Students forever have been looking for the right answers, right?
I know we're looking for the Holy Grail, you know.
In education, we just don't come up with answers to the really big questions of life and why we're here and so on.
Right.
But it is comforting to, and I sometimes think that students who really like mathematics, what they like is that you come to a definite answer.
Absolutely.
Whereas with the humanities, generally you don't. And so tell us a little bit more about the doc. When you say documentaries, you're talking about video clips?
I'm talking about actually using the software that can create a video, digital video. And so their stories are 3 to 4 minutes long or 4 to 6, depending on the semester. So the students were doing stories, and I can give you some examples might help in the sense that they look at, I wanted them one semester to take a look at what was life like on campus. What were they concerned about? How did they socialize? And that sort of thing. And so one of the students did a story about the smoking culture, as in smoking cigarettes. People got together and smoked cigarettes. There were lots of cigarette commercials in the Muhlenberg Weekly. We find out later that those commercials, those advertisements, were the lifeblood. They paid for the paper, so it was pretty valuable. She was stunned to see Chesterfield advertising all these cigarettes. But so the students are really like, how did this happen? But they are thinking from, you know, a 21st century perspective. And so they learn about that. They learn about the fact that women weren't here on campus, with the exception of being a secretary or a nurse. And we had stories about the gardens. We had stories about one particular student named Wilmer Cressman, who had a column in the paper, and he was always current with all the latest scenes about kinds of music. And so he did this whole story about all the, and he had to do all the research to understand what were the genres of music at that particular time.
When you say the paper, which paper?
I'm sorry, it was the Muhlenberg Weekly, which is our school newspaper.
And that, way back then, that was a going thing.
It was the lifeblood.
Still is.
Not so much. We're getting better, but there was kind of a lull. But at that particular time, it was front and center where all the news happened, with the exception of radio.
And we were able to, thanks to the Alumni Association, we actually were able to get that digitized about 3 years ago. And so the Muhlenberg Weekly is now available on the Trexler Library website, and it's keyword searchable. So that has, for preservation purposes and for our project, I don't know if we could have quite done this quite that way if we didn't have such searchability 5 years ago.
Right. So these stories that the students do, like they were football games. When we went to Madison Square Garden, most people don't think about Muhlenberg going to Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, or that's basketball.
Yes.
Tobacco bowl, another one, that sort of thing. So we have, we actually, life was really busy, and to say the least. But that was just campus, you know, it's not the war.
There was a very big sports profile at Muhlenberg at the time, as you're mentioning.
Absolutely.
The NIT finals, there's a picture in the
In the Life Sports Center.
Life Sports Center.
Right.
Exactly, of that. And it's Muhlenberg versus maybe Navy or some big program for one of the final two games of that particular year. And that was during World War II era.
Absolutely.
That was in 1946. And one of the reasons that our sports teams became so dominant during that period was partly because of the influx of V-12 students who had been at other schools that had a more dominant sports programs or stronger sports programs. Now Muhlenberg was able to take advantage of that, and that helped us ride that a little bit.
Were the students in the Navy program at Muhlenberg older than the 18 to 22-year-olds we usually think of?
A few, but not as a rule. No, they were college age.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're pleased that you've joined us this evening. I'm John Pierce, your host, and our operations director, Neil Heaver, is working the board for us this evening. My guests are speaking about World War II correspondence and projects that students are doing nowadays, looking back on those years and how things have changed on campus from Muhlenberg College. Susan Falciani from the Muhlenberg College Library and Dr. Kate Ranieri from Media and Communications. And we are up to another break. We will be back in just a moment.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
So as we continue talking about World War II era students here in the Lehigh Valley, particularly Muhlenberg College, and correspondents as they went and did their military service and then wrote back to the college and the college back to them. And we have a librarian here and a professor who are talking about this project that they are heavily into at this point. How about some surprises that you've come across?
Well,
Kate?
For me, one of the first things that I've noticed when we were going through all the correspondence, that all the students, alums, military, had wonderful grammar. It was just
Hooray.
Yes, I was like, oh, it was exciting.
And mostly lovely handwriting,
yes,
too.
Beautiful.
And that's been one of the things for the students that they've had to adapt to reading cursive that some of them
simply cannot.
If they learned it, they let it lapse a while ago. So learning to transcribe that handwritten material, the manuscript material, has been something of a surprise for them.
We've also learned some of the fun expressions of that particular period of time. That they were, the word swell was swell. And they were talking about people's performances. It was tops. And that struck some of us. I was working with an undergraduate this summer and just got so tickled to the point where every day was something was swell. So we really got into it. But we also found it really interesting the amount of nicknames that people had, which was just fun just for that particular time. Red Paco, Whitey, Mud Hen, Tuss, which I don't even know why that, you know,
those farmer.
Farmer, right? Whitey, Chucky, you know, so they had a lot of cute nicknames. And they referred to each other by those nicknames. And that was fun, just to kind of get a sense of how familiar they were with themselves.
And I think one of the things that the students, in addition to learning to read the writing, was they really had to wrap their minds around the idea that there was language that was being used that's not politically correct necessarily by any means. If you consider who our enemies were at that time and the nicknames by which they might be referred in these letters, that's something that students have to understand the times and the context.
Right.
And for example, as we mentioned earlier in the program, coeducation began at Muhlenberg in 1957, but there had been a push from it, actually a push for it from the Lutheran Church. Pretty much every decade, it was seen as something that was tried to implement. And in the mid to late 40s, I think 1946, the decision was made, we're going to do it. And it got pulled back. It didn't happen yet. But it was announced to the men who were serving that this was something that was going to be coming in the next couple of years. And there were some mixed responses to that. There were some who were very enthusiastic. One said, oh, well, good, my wife's pregnant, so now I don't have to worry about whether it's a boy or a girl. They'll be able to go to Berg.
Yeah.
But then there were plenty who said, why are we going to change this? This is a man's school, and we're happy with it that way.
They wanted to keep it a male bastion forever.
Yeah, so students have had to understand and ponder these issues and the social context of the time and what that means now and how it reflects on their experiences and what they're taught.
It's been interesting for our current students to think about people's reactions to women, and they were stunned by it. But one of the other things that surprises that we saw was how provincial, if you will, people were when they were in the military, in Europe, in the UK, and the way they talked about other people, their culture, their habits, their way they celebrated their holidays, their currency. It was like, oh, let's collect this and bring it all back, and they're going to make a big display about it, which seems so silly to us now, but then it was a big deal. The money was very different, whatever currency they had. And
Allentown was a local school, and there were a lot of Pennsylvania, German farmers who were attending it. And so this was such a broadening experience for them. And really, I think, changed the course, because then they came back. And then, of course, the GI Bill happened and people with these experiences were returning. And so that really, I think, changed the landscape a lot.
I can imagine that it would be exciting, to me anyway, in that kind of a situation where I'm here in the Lehigh Valley, I don't travel much, and I don't have the opportunity to see a pound note from Great Britain or a franc from France or this kind of thing to actually see it in an exhibit. Nowadays, just turn on the computer and put the word in there, and you get an image of it. So it's so very different now.
It was, and they were talking about other things that seem sort of ordinary to us now, but that cognac. Oh, this stuff's crazy. It'll knock your teeth out. You know, they were about different types of alcohol, and that seemed to be a big issue, I think, because they were comparing what was available in England to what was available in France. And for a lot of people, they didn't have those different assortments, if you will, of something to imbibe in. But it was fun. You know, I was surprised for them, I'm sure, too, in so many respects. But that's those kind of stories we got from the letters, or from some of the interviews, like the story about Richard Meyer talking about doing an appendectomy and had never done any surgery at all and doing it in the middle of a typhoon on a ship. Oh. You know, so we get all these like crazy stories that you think, oh my gosh, but they did. You did. You really get a sense about what life was like, far different than what we would ever consider war from a very personal perspective. So that was helpful.
And yeah. Susan, there's one person who was a student at the time, James Hemstreet.
Yes.
Who lived in Easton, and I've seen a few of his letters, and you actually made contact with his daughter in Easton.
Yes,
is that right?
Actually,
daughters,
right.
Yes, and we were able to do that in time for the exhibit a couple summers ago, and I think at least one of the daughters did come and brought some of the grandchildren, I think a brother possibly, and one of the things that's been wonderful is the family members, in order to use some of these letters in displays and anywhere else on the website,
the documentaries,
you
right.
need to get the copyright of those letters, of that material, belongs to either the gentleman who wrote it or to his estate, his descendants. And so in order to use this material, we've tried to contact, and it's an ongoing process, we still are, tried to contact family members to request permission. And across the board, they've been supportive, and we've been able to supply them with copies of, you know, depending on the gentleman and how many letters, this is a nice chunk of their World War II correspondence of their relative that they never even knew existed before.
Exactly.
So we've given them copies of that material
right.
as well.
We've also had some men did not remember writing these letters. And so when, like, for example, it was George Abel, when we handed him this folder of, what is this? And he opens it and he goes, ooh, that's my handwriting. And I'm like, yes, it is. And those are all the letters you wrote. And they have such fun with it. I mean, just the things that they thought were important to write about, which were about how Muhlenberg was doing. And they even talked about things like the best fried chicken I've had in a long time, or, you know, something, whatever was important to them at that particular
time.
They
would reference the Allentown Fair, you know, how they hoped that they could get back in time for that in the summer. And there was such, oh, and the support for the sports teams was amazing.
Yeah.
But there was a plan for a big victory reunion. And they mentioned that all the time, that once the war was over, they wanted to bring back all of these men who had served, thousands of them. There were over 2,000 Muhlenberg students and alumni and affiliated staff members who served during World War II. And it just so happened that the night that they finally got to have their big victory reunion down in Allentown, the Ettinger Hall burned almost to the ground that very night while everybody was partying downtown. Unfortunately, their beloved, it was the administration building, and they called it the Ad Building,
right.
and it caught fire that night, and some of the diplomas were singed. It was
that was what year?
Commencement weekend, 1947. I believe it was May 30th, 1947. And we've had students do documentaries about that.
Now, Kate, when we look at one of these documentaries, you say it's 3, 4, 5 minutes long?
Correct.
What is the viewer actually seeing, and what are we hearing?
Okay, so we can talk about the Ad Building when it burned. That just use that example. So it starts off with what the Ad Building looks like right now, and then you'll see the PR photographs of the building as it was burning. And we have a collection of the flames, the charred roof, how it collapsed, books that were damaged. And so you'll see a whole collection of them. And there's a voiceover that kind of guides you through that story. And then talk about how the building was renamed after one of our beloved professors at Ettinger. And then how that moved, you know, they give a little progress in terms of where it was and how the building has been used. And that. So there's just images of the school, the campus.
So the student has to produce the narration.
They have to produce the narration, but it has to work in an interdependence with the images as well. So they have to, as we teach them, in a nurturing interdependence. So that makes sense to move
that
those.
Is so feminine. A nurturing,
I know, isn't it? But it actually came
that's
from
wonderful.
Somebody by the name of Robert Coles, who was taught at Harvard. That's the text that we use. So maybe he was a nurturer. I can't say.
Yeah.
And they integrate. So in the case of the burning of the Ad Building, they integrate the sounds. They get sound effects as well. So there's some crackling or music that's appropriate for the time. In the documentary about the cigarette smoking that we talked about before, that student was able to get some old Lucky Strike
TV commercials
and the jingles, the TV ads. So the documentaries really are a mix of histories of the college. It might be the music scene or a particular building or a profile of a particular individual on campus. Or it could be something, as in the case of the cigarette smoking, which contextualizes it in terms of smoking amongst members of the military and the role of the tobacco companies and tobacco advertising overall. So it can be looking at Muhlenberg as a microcosm of a bigger social force.
Like the Good Neighbor program that President Roosevelt started and how that became a program at Muhlenberg and Cedar Crest College, which were, you know, brother-sister colleges, so to speak. So they would integrate that story. There were several other stories where we saw bigger pictures, like the one of De Vera and the German club. That story was about this, the notion of Jews on campus and what that impact was. And a lot of our students who are Jewish were stunned that they were forced into going to chapel when in fact they weren't
Christian.
Lutheran. Right. Mm-hmm. And so they just became sort of mixed together. And it's hard for some of our students to see how life was on campus, you know, and that kind of caution, if you will, about how many people we admit, whether they were Catholic or Jewish. It's interesting stories that they uncover some of that.
And some of the students have had the opportunity to bring their own experiences into it. One student was interested in working, examining a couple of letters from men who were paratroopers, because her grandfather, whom she never met, was a paratrooper. And her mother has her material, a journal, a diary that he kept, and some of his war materials. So that spurred her interest in that.
Right.
Another one, she was examining the proms and dances and the big band, the swing culture on campus. And she actually used footage of her grandparents back in the 90s swing dancing at a wedding or an event.
Right.
And she faded that into looking back into the 40s.
It's a lot more personal.
Exactly.
Or like the one with one of our students named Paul Candelino. Her father was in the Navy. Paul was in the Navy. And so she kind of blends those two stories together. And
all of these stories add to not only our database of knowledge about, and this goes back to what I said earlier about coming into a new place and trying to absorb that institutional knowledge. Working with these students over the past year and a half or 2 years has helped me as the archivist tremendously, because I've had a chance to explore not just the historical facts and events and big shifts on campus, but also when a student, you know, when somebody wants to know, well, what were the 60s like on campus, or, you know, anything about how we represented bigger trends, that has, my knowledge has increased incredibly. It's
Absolutely.
Been so beneficial to help them and help share with them, well, this could be a story that might be explored.
And for students, it's been an eye-opening experience that they start feeling a little bit closer. They move themselves closer to, more connected to Muhlenberg. Just a sense of, like, this is my college. And in fact, one student said about a year ago, how are they going to remember me? And he said, well,
yes,
it's something to think
interesting
about.
Interesting question.
Absolutely.
Yes.
They walk across, they go past a building, and now they're like, oh, well, I know that burned in 1947, or I know who that's named after.
I know that Dr. Schenkweiler was, you know, big on pre-med, and the building was named after them. And we know that Seegers was named after the president after Levering Tyson. All of a sudden, it's like, I know these things, and the more you know about it, the more you become connected. And so we're starting to see students really get a sense of who they are and where their place is in the history of Muhlenberg.
Personal
and
that is, connection.
Yes,
absolutely.
It's not just their 4 years, but their place on this continuum.
Right.
And they talk about it. Then when they'll make jokes about it, like, oh, yeah. And so they refer back to all these old stories.
You've been working on this historical project for a year and a half or so. Where do you go from here?
Well, we have... we want to bring it together in a place, as I said, that can be shared. We want this to have a digital home. And so we have been working on a website. It's the MuhlenbergMemoriesProject.com. And obviously the bulk of the material that we have at this point is about the 40s. What we're trying to do is to have sub-pages that study as many decades as we can. Mm-hmm. So in this fall semester, we have started working on the 50s and the 60s. So there are students who are crafting documentaries about different upright protests and co-education and race relations and big issues of academic censorship.
Marijuana use too.
Controversial speakers who came to campus. Mm-hmm. So we're building on, it's almost an endless supply of points of research that students can craft documentaries from throughout the history of the college.
And the benefit of moving to the 50s and 60s is there are a lot more people for us to actually interview.
Yes, we were able to bring.
It does not mean that they're going to stop doing primary research in the archives. Oh, no, no.
You won't let that happen.
No.
So what we're doing is bringing together on the website some of the student documentaries. Right. So some of these stories can actually be told that people can view. The photo collection is featured on there. Mm-hmm. Some of the letters, as we get permission, we start to share the letters. Clips of the interviews that we've done with some of the veterans, the alumni from World War II.
So the interview of Fritz talking about getting busted for falling asleep, you know, we'll have that clip.
Right. So we're
Richard Myers doing the appendectomy on a ship during a typhoon.
Yes. Yeah, so we're trying to bring all of that material together in a place where it can be. You can spend some time with it and listen to it. So you see student work, you see the primary source materials, the interviews, mm-hmm. all of it.
By decade.
Yeah.
Let's give the website again.
It's MuhlenbergMemoriesProject.com.
Well, this brings us to the end of our time together, believe it or not. This is a really interesting conversation. It's a fascinating topic that you've chosen. You've gone back into history to show current students what the college was back then and what society was also.
Exactly.
And it's a blast from the past, we could say, for the students now. And they learn so much about where we were and leading up to where we are now.
Right.
Kate, just one question about the number of productions that you're going to wind up with. How many students do you have in the course?
Right. This semester I have 45 students, but we're working in groups of 2 to 3. So, you know, depends on whether they've got 3 in this group or 2 in that group, you know, but we'll have more stories. What we've had in the past is 15 stories per section. And so we're close to 45 or 90 stories.
Wow.
And we're working on more this semester. So.
And we would just like to, we've had incredible support on campus from the library, from her media and communication department, from our digital learning team. And we couldn't have done any of it without Tony Dalton, who is our
digital
technician.
Cultures technician.
All right, let's give a shout out to Tony.
Yay, Tony.
Susan Falciani, I want to congratulate you on moving from part-time to full-time
at the
college. Yes.
Very exciting.
Nice. And the college did itself a favor by having you in there. I know that just from chatting with you several times.
Thank you.
My guests this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse have been Susan Falciani, Special Collections and Archives Librarian at Muhlenberg College, Trexler Library, and her companion, Dr. Kate Ranieri, who is a professor in the Department of Media Communication at Muhlenberg. Thank you so much for coming over to see us in eclectic South Bethlehem.
Thank you so much.
Here at WDIY Allentown. Thank you, dear listeners. Thanks to Neil Heaver for doing our board work this evening. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.